So we have to thank Pim does this panel every year, and we have two more panelists joining us by telephone from the European Stability Mechanism and the European Union. I'm particularly grateful that we have a great panel here, but I'm also very grateful that we have two of the institutions that are currently in negotiation with the Greek government. So I think this would be a very hot panel. And Pim.
All right. Thank you very much, Nicholas. Thanks very much for joining us, and thank you all for being here. All right, let's get started. U.S.-European economies, the Greece, past, present, and future. Let's begin with an economic outlook, and I just want to introduce our panelists, and I understand that we have a panelist from the European Commission joining us by telephone, Gabriel Giudice. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. Also with us is Mr. Ryan Barnes. He is a senior international trade specialist, U.S. Department of Commerce. Mr. Declan Costello, European Commission Director General for for Economic and Financial Affairs. Brooklyn Dwyer, senior economist, BNP Paribas Global Markets. Pierre Lafouquet, I beg your pardon if I've mangled your name already, senior global economist for UBS. There we go, Gabriel Giudice, and Mr. Rolf Strauch, member of the management board, as you can see. I beg your pardon. All right, no more Declan. Well, that's what happens in banking. All right, gentlemen, let's begin with taking a look at the economy, and maybe we can start with, let's start with the global economy and the macro trends, because I think that that would perhaps set a decent sort of floor for our understanding of what's going to happen today. Brooklyn Dwyer, senior economist at BNP Paribas Global Markets, give us your thoughts. The global economy, the trends, and the trends that you see in Europe and how they would affect Greece.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I think that clearly some of the most important things that are happening on the global economy scale is politics. So we'll obviously come to that. That's obviously the biggest elephant in the room that doesn't seem to go away. So, but I'll come back to that in a second.
Actually, it's just two blocks down that way.
So I think starting out by where we were just before the election in the United States, I think that, growth in the U.S. was outperforming the rest of the world in terms of growth momentum. That was, unspectacular, running at something close to 1.5% in our view. The global economy was on a very slow recovery, a lot of concern about Japanization, both in the Eurozone and the U.S. And now we've kind of broken out of that world, and now people are talking about things like inflation, something that used to be a word that nobody spoke about. People just talked about deflation, those risks that were there. So I think that, what we've seen now is a change and a shift from monetary policy to fiscal policy, something that a lot of individuals at official institutions, as well as economists on the street, have been calling for some time. The devil's in the details there. It's really difficult to get some of this fiscal policy in motion. It's really difficult to get it done. Local politics stand in the way of progress. So that'll be the challenge, not just for the U.S., but also for the Eurozone. A lot of elections on the horizon in the Eurozone, and a lot of expectations that something could go awry and we could get some sort of radical changes ahead. Obviously, with the French elections early next year, and then we have the German elections to follow, and that'll coincide with another decision from the ECB to whether to extend its asset purchase program at the end of next year. So a lot of things on the horizon, a lot of roadblocks, but I think near-term momentum, certainly on the side of the U.S., is that we'll get a bit more stimulus, and that'll kind of lift all boats. That's going to be a bit more challenging for EM, where we're seeing that difference in interest rates really start to take effect, and some emerging markets having to respond, even places which I wouldn't call an emerging market, but Canada to the north, which is talking about dealing with higher interest rates and having to respond to that. So I think that the global environment right now really is about looking at the U.S., looking at the potential impact of fiscal policy, how big that's going to be. It's probably not zero, which means that we're looking at a better outlook for the U.S. than we had previously. It means we probably end up with higher rates, a stronger dollar, And that'll obviously have very important implications for places like the Eurozone, which will probably defer any newfound decisions that they need to make toward the end of next year.
Thank you very much. I just want, I beg your pardon, I want to introduce also a panelist, Yanis Manuelidis. He is a partner in London of Allen and Overy. Thank you very much for being here. Pierre, I wonder if you could maybe, do you agree with what Brooklyn said? Maybe offer the, since you're an economist, the other hand.
I actually agree with the story. Uh-oh. I just want to emphasize the fact that what he's pointing out is a baseline. And I think the story is not so much baseline, but the uncertainty around it. So there are a lot of stories that are going around about the fiscal packages, about indeed moving away from deflation to reflation. I think the important point is there's enormous uncertainty right now. We always say that there's enormous uncertainty, but I think everyone in this room has this gut feeling, it's visceral, that things are really different now than they usually are. And I think... we have a similar story to what Brooklyn said. Basically, it's not a story of great optimism. It's basically marginal improvements around the globe. And there's a lot of hope pinned on fiscal expansions. But the risks are enormous. And the risks are the following. We have no idea what these fiscal packages are going to be. We have no numbers. I think a lot of people have gotten ahead of themselves imagining billions and billions being poured, but we have no numbers, so it's very difficult to figure out where we're going. And the fiscal expansion is just one part of the potential scenarios and the risks that are out there. The other ones that I think are quite important is trade protectionism. We know that the incoming administration is going to take probably a very different tack to the current one. And, well, that comes as a negative to the whole fiscal expansion story. Another one that I think is... underestimated is the possibility of having a full new board at the Federal Reserve. We know that the current chair and vice chair will be, their terms are up in February. The current president-elect has suggested that he's not very happy with what they have been doing. And if they are replaced by new members that are more hawkish, then the possibility of having trigger-happy board members who react to the slightest whiff of inflation will completely offset whatever fiscal expansion is there. You have to remember the point of fiscal expansion is to get inflationary expectations up because they are quite low. But if we have someone who is very sensitive to that, then any will have increases in interest rate much faster than expected, and they will simply crowd out whatever aggregate demand boost we would have had from fiscal expansion.
Pierre, thank you. I didn't hear anything about Brexit. Just a quick question for both economists. Brexit, Italy, those kinds of details. Do you have maybe a sentence each about? Go ahead, Brooklyn.
I'll give a quick line to that. I think that, you know, when the market saw Brexit, you know, they took about 3 months to digest it. You know, with following that, we had, you know, the Trump election, which the market took about 3 minutes to digest, and now we've had the Italian referendum, which the market took about 3 seconds to digest. I think the time frame is getting shorter and shorter, and the implications of these sorts of, in fact, significant policy shifts are that, you know, they tend not to be as impactful as what you think, or I wouldn't say impactful, actually. I would say as dangerous as you might think. So I think that's what we're learning, and certainly with the Brexit time frame being stretched out, looking at potential transparency coming from the Brits, all of that is, you know, some good momentum and leaves less room for surprise.
Pierre, do you have a comment about that?
So Brexit, I think, was a smaller effect on world economy than, obviously, the new administration coming in.
But psychology, perhaps.
Yes, but...
Maybe you could just, we'll do a quick poll. How many people here actually believe that Brexit would happen? Well, England is, the Brits are over in that corner.
So yeah. This is something I would like to pick up on. If you step back 9 months ago, the current configuration of, the current political configuration in the world is so much different than we would have expected. I think very, very few people would have expected the dominoes to fall the way they have. with Brexit, with the elections left and right. There's a sense in which, especially I think in the euro area, in the European Union, there's a lot of adjustment fatigue, and there's a lot of there's a sense that somehow the project is slowly unraveling. And to some extent, I think Greece was a leading indicator of all of this. And I think this is why it's so important that we talk about Greece, because I think Greece sort of has turned into a little bit of a sideshow from a media and interest perspective from the world, and yet the issues are obviously still there, which is why we're having this conference. It's been a leading indicator on so many dimensions, whether economic or political.
Thank you. I just want to note, because I knew it didn't sound right, but you're forgiven. Janet Yellen's term is not up next year. It's actually up February of 2018.
Yes.
Thanks. Let's go to the telephone now, and I want to introduce Rolf Strauch. He is a member, obviously, of the Management Board of Economics and European Stability Mechanism. And I'd like to introduce Mr. Rolf by having him talk a little bit about the short-term debt measures that are currently in place in Europe. Chilling in the meeting. There you go.
Yeah? Okay.
Ryan, please.
Thank you. First, want to thank Capital Link for organizing this great conference and for inviting me to be here this morning. I'm delighted to be here to show U.S. government and U.S. Department of Commerce support for the U.S.-Greek bilateral commercial relationship. We already have a fairly robust trade relationship. In 2015, we had about $2 billion in bilateral trade. Hope to grow that even more in the coming years. We have a very large and engaged Greek diaspora here in the United States, which helps our economic relationship. And so despite the recent economic turmoil in Greece, U.S. companies are very interested and committed to the Greek market. In particular, we see high growth opportunities in ICT, healthcare, border and maritime security, defense and aerospace, travel and tourism, to name a few. But of course, there are also some challenges. Capital controls continue to hamper some business productivity. Arrears continue to be a very big problem for U.S. companies in Greece. In healthcare alone, U.S. companies are owed over $1 billion in debt from the Greek government. There's also an inefficient and sometimes non-transparent public procurement system, and also weak intellectual property rights enforcement. And so in addition to Greece, I cover a few other countries in the region, and I engage quite a bit with my foreign counterparts, and the question is always the same. What can he do to help bring U.S. investment to our country? And because capital is mobile and we're in a globalized economy, you have to provide incentives and a good business environment to attract investment. But it's also key, and I tell this to my foreign counterparts, to treat the investors that are currently in your market well. Companies talk to each other. They'd rather hear from a peer than a government bureaucrat like me why they should invest in a particular country. And so if they have a bad experience in a market, that will deter the investment that all of these countries, including Greece, want. So I would advise that it's crucial to treat the current investors you have as good clients. And so in the U.S. Department of Commerce, we have one mandate, and that's to increase U.S. exports to countries in the global economy, in this particular case, Greece. And we do that in multiple ways. One is trade promotion. We can help U.S. companies match with local business partners, distributors. We do that through a multitude of ways. We have one service called the Gold Key Service, in which we vet potential business partners and distributors and bring a U.S. company to the market to meet those potential business partners. And we also engage in commercial diplomacy. And so once we help a U.S. company get to the market, we engage with our foreign counterparts to overcome any trade barrier or market access issue that they face in the market. And so we're here to help U.S. companies participate in the Greek economy. And I would just highlight a few other things that we have ongoing and we have in the future. Currently, we have 9 advocacy cases. We're helping 9 U.S. companies in public procurement contracts in Greece with over $700 million in contract value. We're also in the latter stages of trying to organize a trade mission to the region, which would include a stop in Greece. And we're also working with the U.S. healthcare industry to come up with a strategic program that would bring potential R&D, clinical trials, and manufacturing to Greece. And so those are a few things that we're working on at the Department of Commerce, and I look forward to the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Ryan, thank you. Let's see if we can bring in Mr. Rolf Strauch. Is he no telephonic connections? All right. Well, let's go to Gabriele Giudice. Let's bring him in. He is head of the unit of the European Commission, and he joins us now on the telephone. Mr. Giudice, maybe you could just begin by just explaining a little bit about your role and where do we stand with the implementation of the MOU?
Yeah, thanks and good morning. Do you hear me? Okay. So I have a very strong echo though, so I will lower the volume. Okay. So my role as a deputy minister for the commission for the actually taking the place of the council, in fact in the place going to talk service.
Can anyone understand what he's saying, or is it just me?
Out of job last month, but I'm
no? All right, you know what? We're going to wait until we get a better phone line to connect with you, because I don't want to waste your time saying things that no one can really comprehend here. Let's go to our another panelist, Yanis Manuelidis, a partner at Allen and Overy. And I have a feeling that as a lawyer, you've got a lot to say. So let's begin with what does structural reform mean for Greece, and then in the context of today's news of the passage of the austerity budget.
Well, thank you very much.
Please.
Now, I'd like to just bring two aspects of structural reforms, which in my view are not always pursued in the right way. And, you know, we all agree there is massive work to be done. And there are two things, really, that I would want to focus. First of all, a lot of little things that hinder growth. And they are easy to do, no major, really, political disagreement. It's just that it's very fiddly. And it's the result of years and years of successive legislation that, if I can just say, was extremely short-termist in that it was introduced to sort out a particular problem, didn't have particularly strategic vision, and that it was sort of layer upon layer upon layer of that years and years has created, you know, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of contradictions. And that needs to be sorted out. Now, it's a massive work, but it can be done by starting with sort of little things. And it's not that, as I said, it's not because there's no political will. It's mostly because no great political cost, but it's mostly because these things are very small and it requires a lot of systematic work. And most of the times they are not in in the field of vision of the politicians. So each one of them, if you went to mention them, they would not appear to be terribly significant. And you know, people would say, well, only a lawyer would think of saying that. But in fact, they do betray something about sort of lack of understanding of how transactions are sort of implemented. I want to give you some examples of that. I mean, we in Greece have an institution of mortgage. And in fact, we never use it. If you look at the bank's balance sheets, you know, you say mortgage loans. In fact, none of them have a proper mortgage. They're all mortgage prenotations, which are judicial mortgages, which means you have to go to a three-member court and say to the court that you cannot pay your loan, which you haven't received yet. So in a way, you perjure yourself as well. So you go there because that's cheaper. It's cheaper. So and we haven't bothered to just change, you know, align the cost of this with the proper mortgage. So we waste an unbelievable time in court time. When everybody sort of complains about not having enough court time. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, we introduce, we advance our law, we make introduce non-possessory pledges. I mean, I know this all sounds terribly academic to you, but, you know, we don't then make a registry. And we then impose a huge ad valorem fee. And the result is nobody's using it. These are the sort of things that you can do to start fixing. There are lots of those, really lots of those, and they have to be done in a cooperation between the private and the public sector. Now, there's one large thing which I'm sure people will turn again and again, and that's tax. And the thing about the tax is, for me, it's very key and it's very big because it has to do with two key issues, namely the mentality of the tax evader that was introduced early on in the crisis when we ran out of money and we then came out, came out and said, well, we actually, you know what, we have a lot of tax evaders and a lot of people who cheat on taxes in this country. And understandably, our partner said, well, you know, if that's the case, you go and get them and make them pay. And we developed this idea that somehow if we go after them, even if the slightest suspicion, we're really going to have a witch hunt, and we introduce very harsh measures, and somehow this is going to make up the money. And that's, of course, it's complete fallacy, because the fiscal gap was never going to be covered by that. And it has introduced, and it's not just the last few years, it's many, many years. And so we have, and I want to focus on one thing, which is very important because it's important for the bank's balance sheets as well right now. We have a lot of corporate NPLs. And right now, if you look at what is the objective liability of directors and also liquidators and administrators on insolvency, there's a personal, very strict personal liability for unpaid taxes no degree of normal due diligence can clear you up on that. And the result is that you have even companies that really ought to go into liquidation, and you don't have officials willing to step in and assume the responsibility because they will be saddled with, potentially, you know, nobody knows, but with personal tax liabilities, which, if over a certain threshold, carry criminal sanctions. Now, that is simply, in my view, wrong. This has to be looked at again. It's extremely important, obviously, that people who don't pay tax are pursued and punished appropriately, but it's also important not to move away from what is effectively objective liability, and you have to really prove that you are not guilty after a very long process. So that to me, is very important, and it has to do not just with social justice and cohesion and moving away from this witch hunt to a sense of membership, the taxes your membership to the sort of civil society that you participate, but it also has to do with a very practical thing, certainly with the NPLs, of unlocking, making investment possible, clearing up the companies that are dead, and so on and so forth. So these would be sort of reforms that I would go for.
All right. Now, thank you, Yanis. We're going to get back to you in just a moment, but at the risk of incurring the wrath of the tax official so early in the morning, I want to bring in, hopefully by phone, Mr. Gabriele Giudice, and he is from the European Commission and the Directorate General for Economic and Financial Affairs. Gabriele, maybe you could talk a little bit about your role, and maybe we could talk about the implementation of the program.
Hi, this is Gabriele. Good morning. Do you hear me? Is it better now?
No, until you keep speaking.
Okay, so I am actually replacing today Declan Costello, who is the mission chief for the program for Greece. He's on his way to Athens right now. I used to be, until last month, deputy mission. I actually moved on further for tasks. In fact, I'm working on the project on deepening EMU, which is quite different. But I was asked by Declan to apologize in his name and then to just give you a few views on the Greek program. So first of all, I would like to make a reference to, you know, what our economic forecasts are for Greece, which are of a gradual pickup during the second half of this year, which and then that would be a growth of 2016 at 2.7%, growing further. This forecast builds on the time implementation of two reforms on the memorandum. So that structural reform can provide the basic economic
progress. Can anybody understand
and,
him?
No,
50%. Is it worth keeping him on? Show of hands. One. Okay, no. I beg your pardon. Gabriel, we're going to have to wait for a better line and perhaps another time. Yes, okay. Bricklin, save us before we go off the cliff.
All right. Just a quick, you know, to kind of pull this together and talk about structural reform.
Can I just break in? I know I'm going to get a lot of heat for this. But the thing that gets me is that here you have the people that are responsible for helping you fix your economy, and they can't – I mean, would this happen in Britain? I don't know. I mean, maybe you can compare it that – aren't those officials, isn't it that important that they are here with all of you today in an effort to make sure that they create the energy and the positive will to actually accomplish something like Yanis says? Because, I mean, these little things, they mean a lot, right? I mean, if someone shows up, that's a big deal.
So let me go a little different direction there.
Okay. See, he's an economist. There's no way I was going to go there.
Rather than calling somebody out. But,
No, I don't mean not on an individual basis. I just mean in the sense of the coordinated focus to bring that, you know, to the public.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what we're trying to do here, what any structural reform is trying to do, is combine two different things. One is reducing debt or having some sort of check on debt, and the other is increasing potential growth. And the channels to be able to do that are quite difficult, right? When you deal with an economy like Greece where you have structural reform, you can do something on taxes and hopefully broaden the tax base and things like that, drive up revenues and try to reduce long-term deficits. That's all great. You have near-term things that politicians can get behind and try to make happen. What's interesting is on the other side is something much less attractive for politicians in the near term, which is dealing with that potential growth. And that's where these long-term programs like education and infrastructure spending and these things that actually, you know, unblock the channels and increase mobility and increased ability and that things like that, those are less attractive to spend money on because the return on that investment is much longer term. So I think that, you know, some of the issues...
Oh, and it also requires people to pay their taxes in order to actually afford all those
exactly.
things, right?
It's a cat-and-mouse game, right? You need both. Right. So I think this is fundamentally what every economy in the world is dealing with right now, the U.S. As well. But the Europeans and each individual economy, they're trying to balance those two things. Right. Make sure they adhere to the European Stability Mechanism and also deal with issues that boost long term productivity.
Yanis, are the institutions in Greece and are the institutions in Europe up to the challenge? And maybe you can give us some guidance as to what needs to happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, are they up to the challenge? First of all, I think we have to remember that, you know, whenever foreign institutions, let's start with the IMF, because that was the first one global institution designed to help with crisis, they are meant to come in and produce advice, but there has to be engagement on the part of the country and ownership of the program, and that is always very, you know, it is always a great challenge. And, you know, it's always a great challenge, I have to say, you know, even on a small scale. I'm a debt lawyer, and, you know, I remember the biggest problem always when acting for banks and making loans to corporates is, you know, you have people who say, okay, where do I sign? And you have people who come and say, well, why do you want to put this clause in? It doesn't fit with what I do, et cetera, et cetera. It's all the second class of person is actually the person who knows, who will always perform well in the loan, even though, you know, the pain in the neck when it comes to negotiations. So there has to be a degree of ownership, and there is a sovereignty line that the international institutions will never cross. Now, having said that, you know, Greece is sort of unusual because it's part of the monetary union. It's a developed economy. It's a big economy. And the problems are problems that are not really capable of initially being analyzed, even by the IMF, let alone by the European institutions, which were sort of made up, and came to the rescue. And, you know, I just want to give an example of that. When the privatization program was initially established, you know, the Troika back then, you know, had this program saying, well, you know, for the next quarter you're going to sell, you know, the gas distribution company, the airport, the whatever, and you're going to get these sort of revenues for the next program. And I remember looking them up and said, guys, have you ever sold or bought a house, even in the context of, you know, an economy where you can get mortgage finance? And Greece cannot get any finance right now, and these are very complex industries. And yet, they kept on persisting, and that led, you know, and I told them at the time, you know, you're condemning Greece and the Eurozone to a rolling three-month crisis. Now, that has, you know, I just wanted to say this historically, you know, to show the institutions themselves are not always fit. They need the feedback from the Greeks. Now, more could be done. Yes, of course, no doubt.
Pierre, your thoughts perhaps on, are there specific trends that Greece can take advantage of? In other words, it is smaller than many of the other nations, so therefore it could be more nimble, supposedly, at least on a rhetorical basis. Are there situations or trends that Greece can take advantage of given the current state of European, let's say, politics right now? People are worried about other things.
Well, I find that actually a worrying development, that Greece's growth is basically hostage to European elections. Basically means that the principle of subsidiarity in the European Union is foundering. And so I'm not very optimistic on that front. Where what I see about the Greek situation is that it's made tremendous efforts on the cost factors of competitiveness. Obviously, the unprecedented amount of belt tightening that Greece has done over the past several years has done a lot to reduce unit labor costs back to the European average. You can see it in indicators. So the World Bank indicators of, I think it's a business facility index. Basically, Greece has jumped 44 places in the rankings, which since 2008. I think the OECD Employment Protection Index basically shows that Greece has got labor markets that are more flexible than Germany. So on the cost side of things, the adjustment has been tremendous, and the effort was completely worthwhile. I think what we see is Greece is still not competitive enough, and you can see that by the export measures, that Greece, given its size, basically is exporting a third less than it should, given the normal patterns of trade that are expected of a country with its industrial nature and its GDP. And a lot of the adjustments that needs to be done are on the non-cost aspects of competitiveness. And this is where Yanis comes in. This is all about regulation, about tax collection, about the institutional framework. There's recent research that shows that if Greece took the institutional reforms to the OECD average, then they could close three-quarters of the GDP of the export gap that they have right now. If you compare Greece to Ireland or Portugal, which are also, for example, small open economies, these countries exported their way out of the problems much faster than Greece has. So I think what I see is indeed that most of the effort now is not on the cost aspects of competitiveness, but on the non-cost, so the institutional framework. And this is where we don't need economists. This is where we need lawyers. I think the situation is Greece, unfortunately is the unfortunate word, but I think Greece has seen a lot of economists, and it needs more lawyers. I think the European Union has seen a lot of lawyers, and it needs more economists.
I sense a job swap coming.
May I just say that I didn't set him up for this.
Okay, well, that's okay. But you guys are sitting next to each other, so no. But you mentioned institutional framework, so let's see if we can get Mr. Rolf Strauch in on the conversation, European Stability Mechanism, and maybe he can comment on some of the short-term debt measures by the European Group and whether they are going to be successful. Rolf, can you come in on that?
Yes, happy to do so. So let me just say a few words on that. First, so we were by your area minister to come up with to support Greek debt sustainability, and so we made a proposal that now so recently adopted. We think this significant. I mean, according to our estimate, this should yield a debt reduction of 20 percentage points in the debt to GDP ratio by 2060. And 5 percentage points in terms of annual gross financing needs in the market. So the estimates, they are uncertain over such long periods of time, but that is what we can say is the best we can say at this stage. So we think it's really significant. There are three elements to that. The first one is that we will do a smoothening of the repayment profile for Greece, which means that we can iron out any future payment humps. The second point is that we will have a couple of measures to reduce the interest rate risk. We will exchange short-term notes that we use to capitalize Greek banks into a long-term note. We will interest rate swap, and we will finance future disbursements raised to the long-term measure. So that should all improve debt significantly, and it will be implemented over the next year to 1.5 years.
All right. Thank you. I guess if we use those words, we can put them together with Gabriel Giudice. Maybe you're on the line. Gabriel, third time's a charm,
yes,
I hope.
Yes, I am. Does it work?
You can just give us an update on where do we stand with the implementation of the MOU.
So after concluding the first review of the program last May, the second review started after the summer. Good progress has been made in a number of missions to Athens in the past week, and today a new mission has started, which explains why Declan Costello, who is the mission chief, could not attend the conference today because he's on the plane to Athens. Now, the policy package put forward in the memorandum is about implementing a broad range of key reforms on the ground with prior actions such as tax administration. Maybe rolling out.
Say that your phone conversations are definitely being listened into by other people. All right. Yanis, we've only got about two and a half minutes left. One of the questions I always have is, we've been talking about this for more than 7 years, you know. All this future look stuff is getting a little... It's not getting any attention because no one believes it will actually happen. Are we wrong? What specific things can you point to that say, this is the path forward, this has been successful, here are the people that are good at doing it? And no is an okay answer, too.
Yeah. Well, I'll come back to tax because that is absolutely key, because it seems to me, I mean, this was, you know, a crisis of a financing crisis, because we had a huge deficit that we couldn't cover from the revenues. It got too big, and debt could not be rolled over. And that has brought in the issue of what's happening with tax collections. Who pays? Is it fair? Is it appropriate? Is it growth friendly, etc.? And that's actually a debate that we really haven't had, I think, in Greece for a long time. We haven't, or possibly well, not that I can ever remember. And, you know, when I moved to the UK, I became very aware of the difference, where everybody, you know, I can go to my butcher and can practically discuss what happens with, you know, the Lord Chancellor's latest statement on taxes. And there's a sense that, you know, taxes is, as I said earlier, a membership fee in the society. And this is not how we perceive it. And that needs to change because it's part of the collective denial we have now about what led to the crisis. You know, coercion from the state is not the solution. People ultimately have to buy in. Coercion cannot solve this problem because people are, you know, who think of treated unfairly will leave, or you know, or if they see that somebody else is treated more fairly, they will cheat. That needs to be sorted out, and it is extremely important to have in sources and uses, if you want, you know, both a justification of who participates and who contributes on what basis, and that it is seen to be fair. And we have already many exceptions today. And then on the uses, there has to be ultimately greater accountability and transparency. And I personally, as a citizen, feel that this is absolutely of the essence. That has always been the birth of modern parliamentary democracy has been actually a revolt on taxes. Indeed, the independence of this country is all part of the same history. And I think we need to come and see that as part of how we will rebuild the country.
So in other words, please pay your taxes. All right, well done. You know, I want to thank you. Anybody have any final statements? I mean, we've driven off the cliff. We've been saved by some little branch that's hanging outside. Giannis, thank you very much. Pierre, Bricklin, Ryan, and our thanks to Gabriel and Rolf. Hopefully they will be more connected to your meeting for the rest of the day. Thank you very much.